Hi, this is Scott Dixon, and you need more front wing.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Waldcraft, joined by my co-editor Paul Dalby, who is a jerk, sitting in nice, lovely, temperate, I understand, backyard, while we're still stuck with close to zero temperatures, zero Celsius temperatures up here in Toronto. That, by the way, I figured out why all you Americans think that Canada's so cold all the time. It's because we use different temperature measuring systems. When we say zero, you guys think we're talking about negative 30 degrees or whatever it is that it works out to be in Fahrenheit.
No, it's just cold in Canada. It's all there is to it.
We're not that different, but we're different enough that I'm mad at you because you're sitting in your lovely temperate backyard with a fire blazing away.
It is beautiful. Can I get you s'mores? Maybe go with an adult beverage?
Or two. Just chilling out next to the fire, so if you hear some pip-popping from Paul's side, it's not fireworks or anything of that nature. It's his lovely little fire that he can't seem to give up to give us all clear audio while we're on the podcast. So, you suck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'll deal with it.
I'll sit in my cozy warm apartment in Toronto, your fire blazing away. But anyway, that's enough whining for one night. We've got lots of racing to talk about. So, pretty well what we're here for tonight is to run down the Toyota Grand Prix of Long Beach that happened last weekend, and we plan to do that for you in excruciating detail, as we always do. And as part of that, later on, you will hear us speak with, you'll hear me speak with Graham Rahal. I had the opportunity to speak with him earlier this week, and we spoke on a number of topics, most importantly, the environment that he seems to be thriving in his current but new but yet not really new team, of course run by his father, Rahal Letterman Lanigan Racing, where he's really found an environment that feels like home to him and that he's a lot more comfortable in than his previous teams. And he goes into that in some very insightful detail that I think you will all enjoy. I certainly enjoyed speaking to him about it, and we will share that with you later on. But let's first get into some of the details about the Toyota Grand Prix of Long Beach. And if we're going to get into that, I guess first things first, hey, Takuma Sato,
Hey, Steph. You know I can't let this go, right?
What?
Do you remember who I said was going to be the surprise victor of the year this year in our preview post before St. Pete?
I know. I was. Uh-huh. I remember.
Come on, who was it? Let me hear. Who was that?
I can't remember who it was. I knew it wasn't me. I couldn't remember if it was you. But if it was you, then fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think I picked Pagenaud.
Come on. You can say it, Steph. Come on.
Paul was right.
Yes.
Twice this week, apparently.
Twice, that's right.
Because nobody got behind my...
You hadn't admitted the first one yet.
Nobody got behind my Nations Cup argument except a bunch of other Canadians, so apparently mm-hmm. No one cares about us. Who knew?
Even an imported Canadian Australian was not behind you.
Oh, that would be my partner, Jacob, who so rarely agrees with Paul, but had to concede that he did on this one. And when Jacob agrees with Paul, I know that I'm not right.
I'm still not convinced it wasn't a sarcastic agreement.
So I'm going to let you have two in 1 week, Paul. Unprecedented. There you go. Don't say I never did anything for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, we're not talking about us. We're talking about Taku. So, yes. He won, and it was great for AJ Foyt Racing for the first time since 2002, I believe, something crazy like that.
Kansas, 2002, you're right.
Unfortunately, AJ wasn't there this weekend, as we all know. He had that back surgery to relieve the pressure on his sciatic nerve. That happened on Tuesday. He got it pushed up by a day, hoping that it would improve his recovery time to get him to Indianapolis in time for the month of May. And so we certainly hope that it was successful in doing so. The team put out a release that day saying that the surgery had gone very well and that he was expected to make a full recovery. So that's fantastic news. And we join everyone else in saying, get well, AJ. But with AJ not being there, still, the team was in winner's circle. And I tell you, I can relate very well to what those Japanese race fans were experiencing. We had a couple of people tweeting us basically what was 8 o'clock in the morning by the time the race ended in Japan, saying that they had been up all night and they didn't care. They were feeling. I can certainly relate to that that kind of race fan experience, and it seems to be one that's not really easily replicated in America. Paul, what's up with that?
I don't know. I don't have an answer, and I kind of alluded to that in our counterpoint this week. I don't know why we don't get behind the American drivers here. I guess it. I think my theory is more just that we look at the international diversity of the series, and we put everyone on equal footing. We just don't wave the American flag just for our drivers, and I don't know why that is, but it seems to be the case. We seem to embrace. I think it could possibly still stem from the fact that, you know, for so long this series was supported by guys like Elio Castroneves and Tony Kanaan, and, you know, going back to CART, you know, the Greg Morris, the Jacques Villeneuve, the Alex Zanardis, and Juan Montoyas. So the American fans are used to that international flavor, and it just seems that it's been so long since we've had that really great crop of American drivers that we seem to be developing finally again. Maybe the American fans are just used to, I don't want to say not rooting for the American, but having built that fan base for the international drivers. That's my theory. I don't know.
Do you think that that's one of IndyCar's woes at the moment, that there doesn't seem to be an American faction for Americans to cheer for? Do you think that that would help?
I don't know. I don't know that, as you've said, I just don't feel that the American fan base is as adamant as it's been made out to be, that it needs to have that American to really root for. Because right now, America has a great American to root for in Ryan Hunter-Reay. He's everything that a role model should be. He's ferocious on the track. He's a winner. He's great off the track. You never hear any negative publicity about him. He does wonderful things. You know, the Racing for Cancer initiative that he's involved with. The problem is, I think, that what he represents to IndyCar is very similar to what Jimmy Johnson represents in NASCAR. It's that whole vanilla, they need a bad guy to cheer for. You don't have that American bad guy in IndyCar that seems to polarize fans. And polarizing or not, when you have those types of fans, it really brings passionate about those fans, either good or bad. I think it was Dale Earnhardt that said, I don't care if they're booing or cheering as long as they're making noise. You know, IndyCar lacks that from the American standpoint right now. So I think.
Does an American fan have to have an American bad guy to cheer for, though?
I would take that a step further. I don't think the American fan needs an American period to cheer for. I just think that the American fans, you know, there's a lot of to-do made in the media about how there needs to be more good young Americans, but at the same time, the series is pressing home that, you know, we want the best drivers. We don't care if they're American, Canadian, Brazilian, French, English, Japanese, Australian, you name it. We want the best of the best here. We don't care if they're just from the United States. We want the very best. And I think that's what a lot of fans see. I think the perception that American fans need American drivers, in my opinion, and I certainly don't want to speak for the entire IndyCar fan base, in my opinion, I think that's overblown.
Well, coming from somebody who came from the background that you did, and knowing that you've been around since 1996, that viewpoint from you surprises me quite a bit, I have to
confess.
Yeah,
but don't mistake where I ended up. I was not on the IRL side of the split for many years after the split. I mean, I was diehard CART through 2001, 2002-ish, somewhere in that ballpark. Probably 2001 is when my allegiance started to cross over. I mean, I wrote a college paper about how much I despised Tony George and how he screwed up so many things. So just because I ended up on the IRL side of the split in the latter years, don't mistake that for where I was in the beginning years.
I learned something about you that I did not know today.
You knew that.
No, I didn't. I swear I didn't. I honestly didn't. And I thought that you were such an IMS diehard that you would never have said anything ill about Tony George.
No, I was, through those, what people consider those dark years from 96 through, call it 2000, 2001. I mean, I was involved. I only followed the Indy 500 from the IRL standpoint. I went, I followed it, but I didn't follow any of the rest of the series. It was, kind of a footnote and a bit of a surprise at the end of the year when I might hear something in National Speed Sport news about who the series champion was. I didn't know.
So you
really
thought that 25.8 was as stupid as the rest of us did?
I assume I did, to be quite honest. I don't. I don't have a great memory of it.
Huh.
I do remember thinking at the time, I must have thought how stupid it was, because I remember at the time how the kart egos were shooting themselves in the foot. And if they just would have said, you know what, all we had to do is show up 1 year and this whole thing is over.
Hmm.
But, do we want to get into that history?
No, and we're getting awfully sidetracked. But
I thought we were talking about
exactly. It's an interesting side note, though, and I think it's definitely something that somebody in IndyCar needs to give a really good hard study, because everything that you're talking about is completely foreign to me. The whole concept of the way that, and I don't want to generalize and speak for all Canadians either, but I mean, I can follow sport that doesn't have Canadians in it. I follow Formula One and I do it on a sort of general level, or I follow the NASCAR and I do it on a general level. But if IndyCar is closer to my heart because it has had more Canadians in it and more successful Canadians in it. And especially right now, when PT was in Champ Car and anytime he drove in IndyCar, and with Tag being in IndyCar, and especially now with Hinch starting to make waves, it's just so much easier for me to feel attached to the sport having a Canadian to cheer for. And I don't know, our countries are so similar in so many ways, but in some ways they're just so very different. And this seems to be a major cultural difference that I just have a really hard time wrapping my head around.
I can't help but wonder, though, how much of it is actually driven by the media. And maybe you can explain. In Canada, here in the U.S., it seems the media wants to focus more on the negatives of IndyCar racing instead of promoting the good stories like the Ryan Hunter race. When Ed Carpenter won last year at Fontana, the Charlie Kimball's great story this year, all these American drivers, yet all the American media seems to want to focus on is, are we going to get 33 this year at Indy? Why are the engines so expensive and elusive to come by? Where are the sponsors? These backroom politics. Let's not even start talking about the administrative politics side of IndyCar. Does Canada, does your media focus more on that, or do they focus on, hey, look, Hinch is doing great this year. Tags has a really strong year going as well. What is the difference there?
I would say that the only times in the last couple of years that I've really seen IndyCar make major headlines here in Canada has been when a Canadian has done well and when there have been bad politics going on. That's about what we get in the sporting to semi-mainstream media, and beyond that, not a whole lot. Unfortunately,
the other thing I wonder is, Canada and all these other countries, Canada, you've always had, one, two, maybe three tops in the sport at the one time. Japan's had one or two. Australia's had, I guess they're down to one now. They had two. Brazil, at their peak, they had five, six, seven, eight, something like that. But I think even now they're down to only two with Elio and TK.
And Ana. At the moment.
And Ana, right. And Ana. Okay, so you got three there. The entire focus of Canada for so long, it started out with Jacques Villeneuve, and then it went to, Paul Tracy was there, I guess, that whole time as well. But it went from Jacques Villeneuve to Greg Moore to Alex Tagliani to Patrick Carpentier.
I remember Scott Goodyear being on the radar in the earlier years.
Okay. So, yeah, but, you had two or three going on. I wonder if the American landscape is diversified. We're not in that spark in that part now, but traditionally, when there have been so many Americans, maybe the instead of focusing all of our energy or our attention on just a single driver or a couple drivers, that the distribution of the attention has led to any of that.
Maybe. But I wonder if somebody needs to look at changing that strategy, because maybe if more emphasis was put on a bit of patriotism, that it could, because I know that that's a great deal of what has been used to draw people into NASCAR, is the overall Americanness of it. I wonder if sort of a look, you can cheer for some Americans against the rest of the world angle might work well for drawing some sort of more general interest. Or maybe
possibly
not. I've had lots of people tell me this week that they wouldn't care either way, so who knows? Could be wrong. Anyway, we're supposed to be talking about Taku.
Yes. There was a race this weekend, right?
There was, yeah. And Larry Foyt said several times that he was amazed at how level-headed and clean a race Taku had, and that's certainly not something that he's been known for, to be frank, and so it's worth noting. But I mean, it was just a picture-perfect, flawless race. Taku picked up the lead on lap 31 after he had a green flag stop, and a yellow flag just happened to go their way, and they never lost it after that. So, you know, great for them. Hope it's the first of many and that it's not a flash in the pan. And the result of it is that Taku is, believe it or not, second in the point standings right now.
I did not have that in my preview.
No. And when you sent me the results for that to put into the event summary, I actually had to go and look it up, because I thought, no, that can't be right. He must have messed something up here.
That's what I told you. I said, I don't think my math is right, but I can't figure out where I'm wrong.
No, but as it turns out, it was correct, and good for him going into Brazil, another track where he's been strong, if my memory serves me correctly. Who knows?
Except the first year where he drove over Michael.
Yes, Herb, well, there was that. the year that he forgot how IndyCar brakes work. but other than that, I think, you know, there's a good chance that we see him going into the month of May very strong, and we all know how last year's month of May ended, and we all know how AJ Foyt, the name, has some impact, you know, a little bit at 16th in Georgetown. So who knows? Crazier things have happened in the sport of auto racing.
Crazier things have happened.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a great race for Taku and the whole AJ Foyt team. What I've loved is, I mean, he really just absolutely blew the field away in the second half of that race. This wasn't something where he got into the lead because of a late yellow, that he wasn't really competitive that much before going into, as we went into that final stint of the race. I mean, he was strong from the very beginning. He was strong throughout the whole weekend. He earned this victory. He put an exclamation point on. He didn't luck into this anyway. And I don't think the fact that, you know, several of the other drivers had misfortune during the race or had incidents of one sort or another, I don't think that had any bearing whatsoever on the outcome of this race. I think this was his race to win. He was dominant through the race. He had by far the best car over the last, would you say, 50 laps?
Yeah.
There was just nobody that was going to touch him. He was in a class of his own all day, I thought.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because the next person that I have on the list to talk about is Graham Rahal, who disagrees with you. Graham mentioned when I spoke with him earlier this week that he felt actually that if Charlie Kimball hadn't been in front of him as a lap car on one of the later restarts, that Graham would have had something for him. But, you know, woulda, coulda, shoulda. It's all in the books now. But Graham's second place finish does spell a very good early result for that team, having all come together just at the beginning of this year. And here's a little interesting factoid. Graham Rahal's second place finish this weekend makes 5 times that a Rahal has been the bridesmaid at Long Beach.
I believe so. That's
yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. So, but I did, as I mentioned, have an opportunity to speak earlier this week with Graham Rahal, and we did cover a number of topics, those 2 points being one of them. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, he had some very interesting things to say about some of the working environments that he's been in as opposed to where he is now, and what effect that's having on his approach to this season. So I think you'll enjoy it. Let's give it a listen now.
Steph Wallcraft, morefrontwing.com, here speaking with Graham Rahal. Graham, thanks so much for your time tonight, and congratulations on your second place finish at Long Beach. Fantastic result for what's really a new relationship, but yet an old relationship with your new team. Can you talk a little bit about the team producing such great results pretty early in the going? And did you expect that going in, or is that kind of a surprise to you?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, thank you. And, you know, I mean, it certainly felt good for us to get that kind of result at Long Beach for multiple reasons. First of all, it's the Long Beach Grand Prix, and it's always grass. Certainly, I guess this is the fifth time that a Rahal finished second at Long Beach, so I would like to win it. You know, but at the end of the day, there's so much history there. It feels really good. As far as the, you know, the team's concerned, I'm not surprised. I think that we've all worked extremely hard. Each and every guy and gal within this team has been handpicked for a reason. And we all have that same desire and commitment to winning. I can't say it comes as a surprise, but it was definitely nice to get that for myself and for this team. I think everybody is, you know, finally feels like all the hard work that they put in over the last couple months is coming together. And certainly after Barber, I think all of us, all of our patience was tested.
Sure. Can you talk a little bit about what your experience has been like essentially going home for the first few races so far this season? And maybe one thing I'd like you to address in particular is what it's like having your dad in your ear in race mode. Is that weird? Is that helpful? What's that like for you?
Well, it's been great to come back to a team and, you know, several individuals that I've known for such a long time. And I think, you know, for me personally, it's I've said this multiple times in several different interviews, but it's definitely the most at ease that I've been in a long, long time, maybe ever, as a driver. And so it's special to be here without a doubt. As far as my dad, you know, actually, quite frankly, it's been nice to have him. And I think more than anything, you know, one of the things I felt like my teams or the teams that I've been associated with over the years have struggled with a little bit has been strategy. And, you know, with my dad, there's absolutely zero concerns about that. So it's been pretty peaceful to have him. You know, as I said, at a place like Barber, when we ran out of gas, I can't say that our radio was the most peaceful place to be listening to. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it's been really, really good to be together as one team. And it was pretty special to see, you know, the tears in Dad's eyes after Long Beach. And I think, you know, for him, it means a lot because I'm sure there was so much weight lifted off his shoulders after getting our first podium. I'm sure he was worried that he didn't want to ever be a limiting factor. So it's all good.
Right. You started to talk a little bit there about your experiences with your current team, obviously, versus some of the teams that you've worked for in the past. And you've driven for some powerhouse teams. Most recently, everybody knows you of having been with the Ganassi organization, but you also back in the day drove for Newman Haas, and they're no slouches either. So can you sort of draw some comparisons between some of the teams that you've driven for previously versus how things are operating for you now?
Well, I mean, you know, at Ganassi, you know, from my perspective, it wasn't a family atmosphere. You know, versus, say, Newman Haas or this team. I think what really all of our mechanics and everybody within this organization loves is that, you know, my dad comes in to the shop, he knows each and every guy by their first and last name. He talks to each of them directly. You know, he's not a guy that is by the controlling power, so to speak, of sitting in his office. You know, I think you'll see him out and about with the guys, taking them to dinner, you know, having barbecues at the track, doing all those sorts of things. That's not something I've seen in the past 2 years. And so, you know, certainly with my dad, he's a guy that is extremely caring for each and every individual. I always felt that Bernie, Carl Haas, you know, Paul Newman, Mike Lanigan, when I was there, that they were the same way. And so I liken this team most to Newman Haas in my days, but I think, you know, the one thing that we have here is youth and ownership. We've got, exciting people behind the company. You know, for Chip Ganassi, his racing team is his business. He flat out makes money going racing and has to. For my father, for David Letterman, and for Mike Lanigan, none of those guys are doing this for a living. They're doing it all because they love it. Now, would they like to break even each and every year? Absolutely. But, you know, these guys are committed to winning. It's not about, you know, every penny to them, and I think that's what makes this team kind of special and different. It's very Penske-esque in that way that, you know, Roger is in IndyCar racing because he loves it. He's fielding AJ Allmendinger and some of those guys out of his pocket because he wants to, you know, and I think, you know, that's the way that our team operates too. We're in this because we love it, not because we're trying to make money off of it.
Right. Very interesting comparison. Thank you. Another thing that I wanted you to compare is your multi-car team experience now, and with James Jakes as your teammate, and you're going to have, of course, Michelle coming in for the Indy 500 as well. That sort of experience of a multi-car team and communication between the drivers and the teams as opposed to what you've experienced for the past 2 years, what kind of comparisons and contrasts would you make there?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's different because we operate as one team. Everything that we do is, you know, with James, myself, and of course, Mike and now Michelle. I mean, it's one team. I mean, we all debrief together. All the engineers are together. We only work out of one truck, versus, you know, I think Ganassi being four cars a little bit different. It's almost impossible to all work as one, simply because it's just too many people in one room. But I can tell you in my time with Ganassi, I never once debriefed with Dario or Scott. And, you know, here, there's no other choice. However, you know, Dario and Scott are two of the most talented, respectable guys in this paddock. I think everybody knows that, but it's, you know, it really is true. And so, you know, I really enjoy being around those two. And so, you know, certainly it's tough not to have guys that have, or different, not to have guys that have that sort of experience. But at the end of the day, you know, I think that we, as a team, and Ray Hall, Letterman, Lanigan, can be just as good.
Right. One thing that stood out in the results at Long Beach is that Honda really seems to have found their footing, as opposed to the first two races of the season, where maybe the Chevrolets appeared to have a bit of a more dominant stance. Can you shed any light on what the difference may have been that led Honda to the top?
Well, I mean, I can't tell you because I don't know. I do know, you know, one thing, and that's that Honda is a group of winners, and they're a group of people that aren't going to stop until they get a victory, or, you know, obviously many victories.
Yes.
And I'm proud of them because I certainly think that the twin turbo setup that Chevrolet has, I think, has huge benefits. Everybody's seen it, and I think it continues to be that way. I also respect the Omar guys almost as much as anybody on the planet, but I think Honda's, you know, reacted very positively to all their criticism and all the pressure that's been put on them. I think it'd be very easy as a company like that to, I don't want to say fold, but, you know, not feel so confident about themselves after a lot of criticism constantly. And these guys, in typical Honda fashion, are just a classy group of guys that they're going to do nothing but strive to succeed, and I think that's what they're doing.
Great. Firestone has been making a concerted effort to make a greater difference in performance in their blacks and their reds this year. Have you noticed that up to this point, and do you think that it's making a difference to the on-track product?
You know, I don't think that. What I've seen is I don't see a big speed differential like maybe expected from black to red, particularly on street course. However, what I do see is that it really, and I can tell you from experience over St. Petersburg and particularly Long Beach, the tires that they produce have made a huge difference in handling from one version to the other, from the alternates to the primaries. I know that my car in particular in Long Beach on reds didn't feel nearly as good as blacks, which some people would say, well, the red is supposed to have a lot more grip, so that should be the obvious best all the time. And what I found interesting particularly was that at St. Pete, street course tire, same tire, pretty well similar sort of setup, and my car was better on reds than blacks. So it just seems to be kind of dependent on, you know, the situation. But I think they've done a fantastic job of that, and that's the way it should be. You know, I think at the end of the day, we'd like to see a bigger time differential between the two. But it just, I think, was setup-wise, it made such a difference that you really just have to get it right. And if you don't, then you don't see the huge time gains, which, again, I'm not going to tell you the bad thing. I think that's how it should be.
Right. Great. You haven't been directly impacted, as far as I remember, by the new rules in qualifying, but it's happened a couple of times so far this year that a couple of guys have had their fast two laps taken away for interference, interfering with other drivers' fast laps. And do you have an opinion up to this point on that rule and whether it's making a positive or negative impact on competition this year?
Well, I think, you know, for sure that it's a good thing. I think that it's something that we should have. I mean, you have to respect one another on the track. And I've definitely been pretty outspoken in the past about the fact that I thought that was really lacking, you know, that guys were working really hard to make each other's lives difficult. And you know, while that sometimes is good in qualifying, I think it needs to be fair and square. And so really, I think, you know, the moves there are really good, and I like seeing them put to use, you know. I try to be a guy that's pretty respectful on the track, but, you know, I think that at times some others aren't. And so, you know, it's nice to see some rules coming in play.
Great. So far in the three races this year, we've seen a Canadian, an American, and a Japanese person walk away with the win. In your opinion, as a young American trying to get more wins in IndyCar, do you see that diversity as good or bad?
Well, obviously, for the sport, I think it's fantastic. I think it's what we have to appeal clearly to more than just the American public and demographics. So I think it's you know, certainly we want to have a lot of success here, but I think it's good to touch all the different countries. And IndyCar racing's always been about diversity, and so I think it's been nice to see that.
Great. Obviously, James Hinchcliffe took his first win at the beginning of this year. Taku just got his first win, and yet at the same time, we're seeing guys like Will Power, who hasn't had a win since almost this time last year. Dario Franchitti's been struggling ever since the DW12 came out. Are you ready to stand up and say that it's ready for your generation, the next generation of drivers, to make their move and step forward and find a stronger footing in the sport, or do you feel that there's still some ways to go there?
Well, you know, it's always tough to meet a guy like Dario. You know, he's just so good and clearly still has the speed. I guess Power is 10 years older than me or whatever, but it's kind of funny because I consider him kind of my generation, I guess, because I kind of, he started only a couple of years before me, so it feels like we're very similar in that sort of aspect, I guess. But
on the other hand of that, you started very young, so
Yeah, well, and that is true. So I guess that kind of makes it different. But I would say that I think our generation is, you're starting to see the speed of our generation. You got, you know, of course, Newgarden, you got JR, myself. Marco is doing a pretty good job this year. I think, you know, certainly Hinchcliffe and others. You got Connor Daly coming in for Indy, and hopefully we'll see him some more throughout the season. I think it is time for a new generation, but at the same point, you look at guys like Elio, still competitive, still winning races at times, and Dario, you know, Dixie, all those guys. I mean, they're as good as it gets, so it's pretty hard to say anything different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's look at it from a different angle then. Do you think that your second win is coming this year? Do you think it's all going to come together?
Well, I do. I do. You know what? I really, really wish Kimball weren't in the way on that last restart, because I felt that had I been in that position, I can guarantee you I would have been all over, you know, Sato into turn one. My restart has been where I made up all my positions, and I really wish that I had that chance. But as I look forward, I think that, you know, without a doubt, we're going to have some great chances this year, and we need to make sure that we maximize those. This, you know, obviously this race gives me a lot of confidence that this team can do this. And so, certainly we'll be pushing hard.
Can you throw out the names of a couple of tracks where you think that your chances are especially high, where people should be keeping an eye out? Mid-Ohio obviously has to be up there.
I would say Brazil, Indianapolis. I think Indianapolis, we're going to have a really, really good chance. I think Toronto, we should be pretty good. Mid-Ohio is always good for me. I think Pocono will be good for me. Fontana. Baltimore, I've always been quick, too, and I've just never, you know, both of my first 2 years, obviously the first year I should have finished second. Had a little pit stop miscue with some strategy issues, and then the next year, last year I finished in the back, but I was running up in second when we had our electronical issues. So that's another one. I mean, I guess there are a lot of places I feel like we got a good chance. We just have to do it, you know. And when I look at it, like, you know, a situation like last weekend in Long Beach, there's absolutely no reason why, as a team, we can't win races. As simple as that. It is just no reason. So I'm pretty excited.
Great. Just before I let you go, I understand that you launched a new website recently. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I had a little bit of an issue with my website last year, and you know, we've kind of revamped it. So I love for everybody to go and check it out, just grahamrahal.com. And then, you know, get with me on Twitter, Instagram, you know, wherever, and give me some feedback. I'd like to hear what everybody thinks. I think, you know, obviously I spent some time and certainly, you know, money on it to try to make it as good as we can. So I'd love to hear what people think about it.
Well, I went to check out the site myself, and one of the first things I noticed is how connected it is. It's Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and YouTube, and that's very reflective of you and your interaction with the fans. So encourage everybody.
Yeah, I certainly.
Yeah, go ahead.
I certainly try, you know, to be very active or interactive. I try to you know, do my best, you know, with Twitter giveaways and all those sorts of things. So, I don't know. I mean, just let me know what everybody thinks, and we'll try to keep active.
Sure. Well, we'll encourage everybody to go check that out. And in the meantime, best of luck for the rest of the season, and looking forward to seeing you and Rahal Letterman Lanigan Racing in Winner's Circle.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Graham.
Lots of really great insight from Graham Rahal, and some very candid comments there, so we greatly appreciate his time. Was there anything that stood out to you there, Paul?
You know, the thing that I thought was probably the most interesting that he said, well, I mean, all of it, what he said was very good and interesting, But what really raised my eyebrow was when he was talking about the different teams. You know, obviously he spent two years at Ganassi, now being at Ray Hall, and he talked about how Ganassi, you know, he's in racing to make money. That is his business. And talking about Ray Hall being, you know, just something they enjoy doing. This isn't their primary source of income, if you will. I found it extremely intriguing to hear him say that he considered Penske to be one of those teams that operates more in the family-like realm, if you will, because we've always heard for so many years how business-like Roger Penske is and how everything, the Penske perfect, if you will, how everything is such a well-oiled machine there. To hear him talk about that as one of the, you know, family-esque type operation, I thought that was really interesting. I think more what he was getting at was simply that Roger doesn't do this to make money. He does it because he loves racing. But still, to hear him make that comparison or that differentiation between Penske and Ganassi, both of whom you typically consider very regimented businessmen and a business-like approach to their racing operations, I thought that was really interesting to hear his take on those.
Yeah, that and many other things that Graham shared with us. So thank you for your time, Graham, and hope to speak with you again soon. As we run down the podium from the Long Beach, when we get to third position, we get to Justin Wilson and Dale Coyne, another strong performance from that organization, which, by the way, marks the first time that we have had a podium with no Penske, Ganassi, or Andretti car on it since the merger, which is pretty incredible.
Yeah, so what's that, 2003 it actually goes back to?
You have to get a little bit more tricky with your factoring who's in what series and that sort of thing. But yeah, to me, the fact that even that hasn't happened since the merger is interesting enough, because it just goes to show that the DW12 has done what it was supposed to do, and that was level the playing field. Now, how long is it until that starts to backtrack? Hard to say. Will it? Hard to say. You have to think that the teams with the money and the experience, like the Penskes and the Ganassis that we were just talking about, their business-like attitude, are eventually going to spend enough to get themselves back up to the top. But, gee, a lot of people thought that was going to happen at the beginning of this year, and it hasn't.
Well, it's interesting. It actually seems to be going the opposite way. I mean, if you look at the beginning of last year, who won the first races? Elio won at St. Pete. Mm-hmm. And then Will Power came out and won at Barber, at Long Beach, and at – no, did he didn't win Long Beach, did he?
Yeah, he did. Three races
in a row. He won three races in a row. Penske had won the first four races going into Indianapolis. Ganassi won Indianapolis. Ganassi won Detroit. And then my memory starts getting fuzzy what the order was after that. I guess Milwaukee was after that.
That was
Ryan Hunter Ray. So, yeah, I mean, you see these big teams over, and then Ryan Hunter Ray won again at Iowa. He won again at Toronto. I mean, it's a long time before you get out of that. I mean, they were clearly – those big –
You're forgetting Texas.
Oh, yeah, I did forget Texas. Okay. So you throw Texas in there, which is obviously the wild card, because who led that race going right up to the end? Mm. Graham Rahal in a Ganassi car. Those teams clearly dominated the first half of the season, and then we started to get some diversification going later a little bit into the season, with Ed Carpenter finally pulling through at the end of the season at Fontana. This year, it seems to be completely different. Yeah, Andretti won the first two races, but going beyond Andretti at number one in the first position, it really seems that the deck is totally shuffled this year. Mm-hmm. Which I would have expected it to go the other way. I would have expected the bigger teams become more dominant, and it's just not what we're seeing.
No, it's pretty amazing. And you mentioned Will Power. We're actually now going into the race weekend that marks 1 year since Will Power's last win. Can you believe that? Did you imagine that we'd be sitting here a year later after his three walking away wins that he started with out of the first four races last year? Did you really believe that we would get this far without him winning another one?
Never would have guessed that.
Never. No. It's really quite remarkable, and I'm sure it's weighing on his mind. Chad Smith, one of our new contributors at More Front Wing, actually took a closer look at that issue in an article that was posted to the site last week. So if that's a topic that interests you, please go back and take a look at that. It was an interesting study in what might be going on in Power's head. I'm sure that he's starting to get to the point where he's got a little bit of a monkey to kick off his back.
I'm sure it's bothering him at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, he was so, there was no indication of it either, was what the shocking thing to me was. He was so strong coming out of Brazil, and it's like somebody just shut the switch off. It was amazing.
It is. Speaking of people who have monkeys to get off their backs, I guess you could say that Dario Franchitti did a little bit this weekend after taking the pole and then finishing fourth. Overall, you know, not a weekend that a couple of years ago we would have considered necessarily super strong from Dario, but considering the year and a half that he's had, he's got to be pretty happy about that, you'd think.
You would think so. I think it was just a matter of time until he does shake that monkey. You know, I wouldn't be surprised to see him struggle again at Brazil. Not that I think he will, but I'm just saying it wouldn't shock me. But come Indianapolis, he's gonna be strong there again, as we saw last year. He knows how to get it done when the money's on the table.
Yes, of course. Let's talk a little bit about Dario's teammate of sorts, or maybe not, as Graham may have alluded to a little bit, Charlie Kimball, who, you know, coming out of Barber, we were talking about what a great weekend he'd had, and is this a new Charlie Kimball? Well, it seems maybe not. he managed to take Alex Tagliani out and then trundle around in the back as a lap car for most of the race, and then get in Graham's way on the restart and affect the outcome of the end of the race. So, you know, disappointing, especially after what we were talking about coming out of Brazil. Now we sit and play the waiting game of, well, which one is going to be the one that sticks? Is Barber going to be another flash in the pan, or are we going to see fewer of these kinds of weekends for him? But that consistency is starting to once again look like it's really lacking this season, and that's a shame, because Charlie's in what, his third year now in the series, and he's in a Ganassi equipment. We're starting to run out of excuses here.
Well, let's not make too many generalizations off of one race here. I mean, he still looked strong at St. Pete and Barber. He didn't look that bad at Long Beach. He had the mistake where he took out Tag when he was dive bombing him into turn eight, but you know what, Ryan Hunter Ray did the exact same thing a few laps later to Ana Beatrice, so it wasn't like it was a completely unprecedented move that nobody else happened to have. So, you know, I'm not ready to say that Barber was a complete fluke, but you know, we'll see what happens going on from here.
That's about all we can do. How about AJ Allmendinger, who it was not his fault, his DNF this weekend, but he's now two races into his much anticipated comeback, and we haven't seen much yet. Are we getting concerned? Not so much. Do we think that it was too much to begin with?
I think the expectations were a little high to begin with. I mean, this is a very, very, very good field of drivers, and to expect somebody to come in to run up front who hasn't been in an open wheel car in general in 7 years, and let alone done what, like two test sessions in the DW12. I mean, that's a tall order to ask of anyone. And AJ's as talented as they come, but you still don't just jump right in and expect to run up front. Even if you're running in a Penske car, you don't expect to run up front and be that competitive in race trim right off of the bat. I think we're seeing that he has the ability to qualify well and drive well, you know, for a handful of laps, but to get it done over the course of an 80 or 90 lap event, that's asking a lot of anyone.
I guess my only point to add to that is that I'm starting to feel a little bit more annoyed that he was treated like the second coming. Not that my expectations or anybody else's were or should have been high, but, and I suppose if you're doing PR, then treating people like the second coming who aren't is what you're supposed to do. But it's just, you know, the crying wolf is getting a little old. So I guess we sit back and wait and see. Give him a few more shots. If he gets a few more shots, the money's still got to come from somewhere. But if I guess if Izod feels that he's representing them well and that having him in the series is worth the extra money to them, then go too. We'll find out. Here's a question for you, Paul. How about that mm-hmm. Sebastian Saavedra?
Oops. Oops. Yeah, he looked so good at St. Pete for so long before he kind of took out Hildebrand and took out himself. But yeah, what was he, like five laps into the event before he...
I think it was lap one, actually.
Was it the first lap?
I believe so. Let me just...
I mean, he didn't just brush the tires in turn nine. I mean, he clobbered the wall.
Yeah, he sure did.
And it wasn't just a little overdriven that corner. But
I'm just looking for the stat, and I don't actually see it. No, yeah, it was lap one. No, well, actually, he completed lap one, so it was lap two, excuse me. Yeah, not so great.
No, not one of his better efforts. Not a good race.
No. Are you at all concerned about that wheel that came flying off his car?
You know, I noticed that, but I didn't get a good enough sense of what caused the wheel to come off. Not that it probably makes that much difference, but was it a failure of the SWAMs that are supposed to hold the hub on, or did the wheel actually just come off of the hub? I think that I'd be interested to know what that was.
I guess we'll have to look.
In this case, they got lucky that it just kind of harmlessly rolled down the road. But I'm sure IndyCar is looking into it to see why that came off there.
So how about Mike Conway, who had a very, very strong weekend? And of course, he's won at Long Beach before, so that didn't really surprise that many people, other than the fact that it was a one-off drive. Very strong until electrical failure eventually took him out of the race, which was disappointing because he was right up there. So that leads into the question, is it possible that a twisty-only career is feasible for him?
I don't see why not. I mean, if that's the way that he feels comfortable going, I think there's enough driver or enough owners that could be looking for a twisty-only career, especially if you want to put him against somebody else who really wants to do the ovals. If you want to look at like a Brian Clausen entry, where you put Brian Clausen in on the ovals or someone of that type, and put someone like Mike Conway, who's obviously very talented and skilled on the road and street courses. We there have been so many times when over the last 4 or 5 years where drivers, we've thought for sure they've shot themselves in the foot and killed their career. Lo and behold, they get another chance and they make the best of it. So I don't know. I thought for sure Conway, after he bailed out at California last year, I thought for sure he was done. But he certainly proved this weekend that given a great car like Rahal Letterman-Lanigan obviously prepared, that he's a great driver who can push that car to its limit and really get the best out of it.
Mm-hmm. We're going to do a little tribute to Marshall Pruitt here and give out the Golden Yo-Yo Award, which goes this weekend to Tristan Vautier. So he started the race with an engine penalty. He started and then was immediately penalized for contact with Scott Dixon on lap one. So he
Oops.
Dead last again, despite making some headway on the start, and then worked his way back up to the point where he was scored second place when he pitted on lap 51. But of course, that was the pit stop where his crew released him into the back of Will Power, and he had to serve another penalty for unsafe release and ended the race in 17th.
Did you get the NBC Sports Network broadcast up there, or did you guys have a different?
No, we have been getting the NBC. The only one that we had the add-ons for was St. Pete, and I think we're getting that again for Indy and Toronto. And as of right now, those are the only three that's planned for. So,
did
yes.
you get the sense that Wally Dombeich had absolutely no idea what he was talking about with that Vautier power incident in the pit lane?
I got the sense that Wally kind of didn't really just seem to be taking the whole thing seriously from the pre-race lap drive around when he was being Bozo the Clown next to, was it TK?
Townsend Bell, yeah.
Townsend Bell, sorry. Yeah, a bit much.
I mean, that pit stop thing, he just kept railing on Tristan Vaudier. That's not his.
That's not his fault.
No, it wasn't. It showed bad on Wally, because it just showed that, you know, not only did it make it sound like Wally wanted him to, you know, turn around, check his blind spot before pulling out. I mean, and then he acted like, you know, this was a huge incident, like, what was it, back in 91, 92, when you had the Emerson Fittipaldi and Michael Andretti incident there on pit road?
Different. Completely different.
Completely different. I agree, but you would have thought Wally was watching the same incident.
No.
I mean, Tristan moved about a total of 5 feet before he, you know, noticed that he had just run into Will Power.
Actually, this is coming back to me now. I remember thinking at the time that Wally was he was talking about the incident like it happened at the time that it took to happen in the slow-mo replay that we were watching.
Right.
He wasn't taking into account that, of course, Tristan moved like 5 feet because it was a split second.
They told him to. The guy says go, you go.
He didn't exactly have time to go, oh, sorry.
Yeah, let me unbuckle here. Hop out of the cockpit, turn around here, check my blind spot, and then I'll proceed with caution. No, the guy says go, you go.
Exactly. No, it's crazy. And I saw some people criticizing, too, the decision to penalize the team for unsafe release. And I don't understand that at all. To me, it was a very cut and dry call.
Yeah, you have to penalize that. I mean,
they affected Power's day.
They affected their own day, too.
Well, yeah, but more importantly, they affected Power's day, which is why the penalty is warranted. I didn't have any issue with that whatsoever. I thought it was well handled.
No, I would expect that they should always handle it in such a way.
Let's see. Who else should we talk about? Elio, still in the points lead.
Where did he end up finishing?
I can tell you in a second. He finished... You're supposed to be talking and filling time while I'm finding this. 10th.
I'm pulling up the More Front Wing event summary.
Well, I already had it, so I'm faster than you. He finished 10th. But has the points lead.
Well, there are a lot of guys.
Some people very excited because, you know, oh my gosh, Elio's never won the title. He's going to win the title. Ah, it's been 3 races, people. Calm down.
Yeah, didn't we have the same discussion last year?
I think so. I guess we could get into is he ever going to do it, but it's all speculation.
It's so early still.
Yeah.
Let's have this after Toronto or Pocono or, you know,
I guess
right before California.
How many chances has he got left?
How many what?
How many opportunities to get the title does he have left? I guess that's the more pertinent question.
You got to think he's going to have a couple, but...
Not much more than a couple, I wouldn't think. So, does he capitalize? Only time will tell, but not yet. Let's wait for like 10 more races before we start speculating, please, people. Calm down! Tony Kanaan's hand injury, do you know whether that happened during the Hinch incident or the Serbia incident? Because as it turns out, TK actually got himself into a fair bit of trouble this weekend.
I have to assume it came at the Serbia incident, the one at the end of the race.
I thought so too, but I never actually saw confirmation of that, so.
I mean, that's the only one where he really hit anything, wasn't it?
I skimmed through some of the media reports and didn't actually get a much closer look at the Hinch incident. I'm assuming it was the Serbia one just from the nature of it, but...
And typically when you have those ligament injuries, it's typically when you have the wheels snap around on you, which you would expect when, you know, you hit those tires very quickly and can't get your hands off it. So that's kind of what led me to assume it was the Serbia incident there on the last few laps.
Right. Anyway, all that to say that just wanted to bring up that TK's hand is not, there's nothing broken in it. It's swollen, but he's got it on ice a whole lot, and he's complaining about it a lot on Twitter. So he is expecting to be okay for Brazil, which I'm sure has a lot of people relieved, both in Brazil and in American companies that have a lot at stake of him being in Brazil. So good for TK. Looking forward to seeing him down there. What do you think, Paul, of this new rule in qualifying that's seeing drivers penalize their two quickest laps in a session and not being moved, not being advanced if they interfere with another driver's fast lap?
I think it's necessary. You know, when you have competition like this where the difference between first and eighth is, you know, literally within a couple tenths of a second, you have to police that the guys aren't in any sort of way inhibiting each other. You know, you don't want this to be a game of cat and mouse. You want this to be the guys going out, running their hardest, having a best opportunity to make it into the next round. So I have absolutely no problem whatsoever with these penalties where they lose their two fastest laps. You know, here's the thing. I don't know if they announce those penalties right away.
They have.
But if I'm one of these drivers, I'm out there trying to lay down three good laps. That way I know if I lose two, I've still got a good lap left.
It's very rare that there are three good laps in the tires, Paul.
I agree. But it's the price. I mean, it's something you have to try, I would think. I don't know.
You kill your opportunity for your one really good lap if you try for three sort of okay laps. I think you need that one really good lap to have a chance in this ultra-competitive field of moving on to the next round.
Yeah, that's the downside of these red tires, is that they are so, you know, that peak is so short on these that you only get one or two good laps.
Mm-hmm.
But then the problem is they never go, you know, they fall from 100 to, you know, 98%, 97%. But then they stay at 97% for about the next 30 laps.
Right. Well, yeah, but once you fall much more than that, you start getting into F1-type predicaments, and that's a whole other kettle of fish. My concern with the qualifying rule is not its existence. I'm with you. I think it's very important that the rule exists. My concern is that the only way that it seems to be implemented is when the driver with a beef goes to race control and complains about it. I don't see any other way that race control appears to be making these calls other than hearing protests from the teams. I think it was at Barber, and of course I remember this incident because it was, you know, my Canadian driver who was involved in it, but don't be picky on me. I think it was at Barber that Hinch felt that Power, though he didn't call him out by name, had interfered with his fast lap, and he told IMS Radio about it. But then there was another driver, and I apologize, I can't remember who it was, who complained not to IMS Radio, but to race control about
Justin
the fact,
Wilson,
was it Justin,
yeah.
That his lap had been interfered with, and then the driver that blocked him got the penalty, but Power didn't. In fact, as far as I know, the Power incident didn't even get looked at. So, understanding, of course, that race control is up against a great deal of time restraint because they have to make these calls before the next session starts, as, you know, we saw with Tristan Vautier and Barber scrambling to get on the track and only getting there with about 3 minutes left to go in the session because a decision was made and it took that long for the team to get it together. You know, that is enough of a challenge in itself, but I guess I just have a real concern about the fact that the only teams that are being served by this rule appear to be the squeaky wheels, or the people who are complaining to the right place. So if you get a driver or a team that's more inclined to complain to themselves than to race control, those people don't seem to be benefiting from it. And then you get into the potential problem, of course, of everybody pointing fingers at everybody else and, you know, just bringing qualifying to a standstill, and that can't happen either. So my feeling is that there's a fair bit of learning and back and forth that needs to be gone through before this rule is going to be truly effective, but good on Bo Barfield for, you know, putting the hammer down and proving that he is going to do something about this, because at some point the drivers will all learn that if this happens, you're going to get penalized and it's going to suck, so don't do it.
Right. Well, we don't know that the Hinchcliffe Power incident wasn't investigated.
I don't think it was. I think we do know that it wasn't. I'd have to look back through my notes, but I'm pretty sure that it was never looked at.
You know, it would be nice if the drivers themselves would just police these things, because I don't think in either incident, whether the one at Barber or the one at Long Beach, I don't think that either one of those were intentional blocking situations. I don't think Taku meant to block Justin Wilson at Barber. Wilson just happened to catch him at a bad time when, you know, Takuma wasn't paying that much attention. ideally, you would think if you're that far off of the pace on a hot qualifying lap, or you know, you've done your hot lap and now you're kind of just off the pace tooling around, that you would be off the line paying attention.
Yeah, well, see, and that's why I don't have an enormous problem with it. If you're going to be willfully ignorant or ignorantly ignorant, I think the penalty should be the same.
Right. So, the drivers need to take the responsibility on themselves. All he had to do was move out of the way. It wasn't going to cost him anything. He wasn't on the lap. So,
yeah,
I have
okay,
no problem.
Okay, so you and I are saying the same thing in different ways, basically, is that the drivers need to learn.
Yes.
To follow this rule.
And, yeah, and if they don't follow the rule, then they deserve a penalty.
Penalize. Yeah, and eventually they'll get enough penalties, or there will be enough penalties going around that they'll start going, oh, hey, we got to pay attention to this, and they'll learn not to do it.
Right.
You know,
we agree.
Yeah, I think so. Ultimately, it's a good thing. It's a good thing for competition, because we want to see guys go fast, not keep each other from going fast. Right. So before we sign off for the week, let's deliver this really bad news that came out today, where we've learned that Panther Dry and Rybull Racing, from the look of things as of now, will be closing up shop after Indianapolis due to a lack of funding. Now, a lot of people, I have to say, are focusing on this. Can Oriel Servia please catch a break? Side of things, and that's very, very warranted. This poor guy cannot get a study ride to save his life, but you know, there are a whole lot of people at the shop at Dreyer and Reinbold who are going to be unemployed mid-season too, and that's not a good situation for anyone or for the long-term stability and health of the series.
Yeah, that's just a terrible situation. You never want to see a team close up shop, but certainly not in the middle of the season.
Yeah,
they lost a longtime sponsor, too, over the offseason when Trans Systems, an engineering company that had been with Dreyer and Reinbold for the last number of seasons, parted ways with them and went over to Ray Hall Lanigan. So I don't know how much that plays into the financial woes of the team, but I'm sure it doesn't help.
Yeah. You just know that this is going to be one of those situations now where Oriel's going to win the Indianapolis 500 and not show up at Detroit. That's just, it seems to be the way that things go, unfortunately. But, you know, that wouldn't be a bad thing.
We still hope for the best for that team.
I think that most of the people that I know at Dreyer and Reinbold would be pretty happy with that result if they won Indianapolis, even if they didn't get to show up at Detroit. I think they'd still walk away pretty happy.
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah.
I think they would consider that still successful.
I think so. Yeah. So one other just quick note before we sign off is the news was released this week that Michel Jourdain will once again be I said that with a French accent, and he's not French at all. He's Mexican, so I don't actually know how to say that with a Spanish accent. We don't speak Spanish very much up here. Anyway, that guy, he's back for Indy with Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan, which will make them a three-car team once again, which brings our count up to, what, 30 or so?
I think we're at 30, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm not one of these breathing into a bag over the car count types. It always seems to sort itself out, so I just kind of sit back and wait for everybody to stop panicking.
It will. It will. We'll have 33.
You don't think 34?
Well, we'll have 33 starting the race.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Isn't that what matters?
Yeah, it is. Oh, although bump day would be pretty boring if there wasn't something to bump, although it's not that exciting with 34. It was pretty good last year, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, the last couple of years they've had a few more.
Kind of lost most of its steam for me when Ryan Hunter Ray bought his way back in that one year.
Quit being such a sourpuss. That's old. Come on, get over it.
But what is bump day means nothing if somebody can get bumped and then just buy their way back in. But the guy who allowed that is gone, so maybe it wouldn't happen.
Who?
Randy Bernard. That was all his idea.
What?
He was the one who defended the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, maybe he defended it, but it's not his idea. It's not like it's never happened before. It's not an unprecedented story.
No, not completely, I suppose, but he was the biggest proponent of it.
Oh, I'd say Michael Andretti was the biggest proponent.
Fair enough. On that note, is there anything I've missed to your mind?
The only thing we haven't touched on yet is the dominance of Honda in Long Beach, which I thought was interesting. And
great.
It'll be interesting to see how they go forward from here.
Yeah. No, it's true. And like I said, Graham didn't give us any insight into that. Unfortunately, I was hoping he might give us a clue. But nobody ever wants to talk about why the engines are doing what they're doing because, you know, maybe Chevrolet listens to our podcast. Who knows? Probably not.
I'm sure Jim Campbell himself is sitting somewhere right now listening to our podcast on an airplane.
On his way to Brazil, maybe.
Maybe.
I'm just trying to think back to, of course, Willpower won last year at Brazil with Chevrolet. So, but we don't know what's going on with Honda. But, I don't have much to say about it other than, yes, that's a story to watch.
Yeah. I don't either. It just it was a remarkable turnaround from St. Pete.
Okay. Way to contribute there, Paul.
I try. We'll just throw our friends, Dan Layton and C.E. Hale. We'll throw them the bones and congratulate them on a very fine weekend.
Yes, that is a lovely way to end our podcast for this week. So next week, we will be back to preview Brazil, see who we can talk to, what news we can bring you. And on that note, we will call it a day. Thank you, as always, for listening. We greatly appreciate your support. And we'll be back next week to fill you in on all of the happenings in the IndyCar world. And in the meantime, if you do need any IndyCar news and views, get a grip with More Front Wing.